Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Matthew Stewart, 37 years of combination experience, Assistant Chief of Operations for Wayne Township Fire Department in Indiana, second ever out-of-state candidate to complete the Georgia Smoke Diver program, who then decided to implement what he learned, bringing it back to his home state and started Indiana Smoke Diver, in which he currently serves as president. Indiana Task Force 1 member and overall chief who has never forgotten that he is still a firefighter. The discussions Chief and I had should make for great conversation amongst the listeners. My favorite quotes from Chief were, "Nothing we do is safe, and you are your own best project." With that, I present Mr. Matthew Stewart.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity. My name is Matthew Stewart, and I work for the Wayne Township Fire Department in Indianapolis. How did I get into the fire service? So I've done this for a little bit. Had some friends actually when I was in high school in Wayne Township where I work now. Back in those days was volunteer. I kind of noted it as the largest volunteer fire department in the country. Five stations. It's in the city of Indianapolis, so it was pretty busy and had about 500 volunteer members. It was very much structured like a career agency. You would stay at the fire station. I mean, you would pull shifts. Really very similar to a career department. Pretty heavily involved in training. They provided a lot of training opportunities. Anything you wanted to get into, they would facilitate that. You just didn't get a paycheck. So did that, started in 87, had a couple friends that I went to high school with that they were already involved, tried to get me to join. And so it took me about a year to decide to do that. So I came on as a volunteer then when I was 17, which was in the cadet program. man, right away was like, yeah, this is sweet. this is cool. I didn't have any family involved in the fire service. I'd never been around it. Didn't really know anybody that was in the fire service. It was just, you know, totally just a foreign thing to me. So about a year I got my training in and was making runs. And one of the first runs, I wasn't on the initial run, but you know, if you look back, I wasn't even through any classes yet, but there was a military aircraft that hit a high-rise hotel here in Indianapolis. It hit a Ramada Inn. I think it was like 10 fatalities. It was a pretty significant event, and I actually got to go to that scene, not as a responder, but like picking up hose and, you know, just doing stuff like that later in the day. I guess I can't get in trouble for this now, but we actually bailed out of school. We were in high school and we heard that went down. So we cut out and headed to the firehouse and then we got down there to help with some cleanup stuff later. So that was really kind of like my first run. Like I said, I didn't respond to it, but just to see that, it was like, I mean, that was something. And then just being at a, like I said, a busier department, we did a decent fire load and really just fell in love with the whole concept of that and, you know, the fire service and the service side of it, you know, serving people, helping people. I know people like to say that's kind of a, you know, I've helped the community and sometimes it could be a little cliche, but I really enjoyed that side of going and, you know, helping people. That really became a real thing. We'll talk about how that's developed. So that's how I got into it. And then I went to college and I became an aircraft mechanic, worked for US Air for a while, but man, I still had that fire service itch going on. And so they closed their operation here in Indianapolis and I decided to stay. And at that point I was like, man, I just want to be a full-time firefighter. So I started applying. I got hired on a suburb here, in Indianapolis, in 95. I worked there for 5 years, and then at that point, Wayne Township decided to go fully career just because of staffing, and it was getting so much busier and things. And so then I applied here, and then I came back to Wayne as a career firefighter, and I've been here ever since. So,
okay, wow, and yeah.
now you are the assistant chief of operations. So it's safe to say you have climbed through the ranks.
Yeah, I have. And I started as a, you know, the agency, the suburb agency, which was Brownsburg Fire Department. It's just right outside the county. You know, I started there. I'm a paramedic, so a firefighter, paramedic, rode the ambulance, did all those things. That department was growing and building stations at the time, so kind of grew there. And then moved over. I was ended up as as a battalion chief there just because they were so rapidly growing. So within 5 years, that's where I ended up. And then when I came to Wayne Township, they were building it out, you know, top to bottom, because they didn't have any career folks at all. So I tested and came in here as a captain.
Okay.
And so, but at Brownsburg, I was a driver, lieutenant, you know, like I said, ended up as a battalion chief, firefighter, paramedic. And then when I came to Wayne, I served as a captain for several years and then came up as a deputy chief for a period of time. Then I went back to the street, served as a captain on our busiest ladder company, does a lot of special rescue, technical rescue things, pretty good fire load. And then I became a battalion chief, did that for about 2 or 3 years. And then I came up to the administration as the assistant chief of emergency services, which is essentially operations.
Okay. And with that being said, can you tell the listeners, including myself, the size of Wayne Township, approximately how many firefighters, your staffing level, things of that nature? Yeah.
So we have five fire stations. We have Wayne Township is about our fire response district. Wayne Township is about 39 square miles. We do about We'll probably be a little south of, but close to 25,000 runs this year. So we have a, you know, again, our guys are pulling lines weekly. Now they're not on the, you know, the biggest fires, but I mean, we get a decent amount of fire load where guys are probably pulling lines. Now it could be room and contents or something like that. Or, you know, we've had a little bit of a run here of second, and we just had a third alarm apartment fire just a few days ago. So, and it's like everybody else, you know, it seems like we'll be running hot for a while and then you get 3 or 4 weeks of a dry spell and it's like, but we're fairly active. Again, we're butt right up against the city of Indianapolis. So we do a lot of mutual aid with them surrounding counties. We have an integrated automatic CAD dispatch. So it just pulls the closest stuff. So it's very rare for us to have any event, really above a residence fire that we don't have probably 3 or 4 agencies on. So that's our run load. We have 5 stations, 5 engines, 2 ladder companies. We have heavy extrication teams. We have a hazardous materials team. We have surface water, swift water. We have 2 boats that they run. We have a low angle rope team. So our double companies, the engines and ladders, one takes care of the hazmat team of some small water duty and light extrication. And then our other double companies takes care of the swift water, the boats, heavy extrication, and then some low angle rope duties. And then our other 3 are just single engine companies. Okay. And we do first response EMS. We don't have a transporting ambulance service, so we run with Indianapolis EMS, which is the city agency.
Okay. And on if a first due structural box comes in Wayne Township's area, what's your initial first alarm sign?
So if it's a residence, single family dwelling, we'll send 3 engines, 2 ladders, chief, a safety car, and an ambulance. And then if it's marked working, we'll get, like our EMS duty officer, we'll get a like arson investigation and things like that. So, but our really initial firefighting operations is 3 engines, 2 truck, and like a couple chiefs, safety car, and a battalion with a driver. Our battalions have executive officers.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the culture, is it engines do engine work, trucks do truck work?
Yes, that exactly. Our trucks don't have hose. They don't have water. They're massive toolboxes, you know, and both of them have extrication equipment. Our heavy one has a substantial amount of extrication equipment, lifting capabilities, both airbags and Paratec struts, You know, they have hand tools, come alongs, chains, all those chains. They have all that stuff. They have three sets of Hamantro extrication equipment. And then they have the, you know, the firefighting tools. They also have a bit of water equipment. And then we have a tactical vehicle that carries the bulk of their water equipment and tows the boats. And then our engines are just, you know, do EMS, frontline EMS, and they just got a ton of hose on them. We don't carry a lot of extra stuff. We're pretty much focused on them getting water, you know, whether it's through an 1¾-inch hand line or a deck gun or anything in between. We want them to be proficient with delivering water and not focused on a bunch of other stuff. And we want our trucks to be heavily focused on search primarily, and then laddering, obviously, to support that. And that's where we want our people's heads when they go to a fire. You know, we're not, we don't want a bunch of extra noise going on.
I like that, extra noise. Yes.
Yeah.
And your staffing levels across the board.
So we run four, our minimum staffing. We have a union contract and all, but our minimum staffing is four per truck. So we'll have four on engine, four on the ladder. We have Kelly days here. So we have five assigned to every truck, but generally we run four. And we do that well over 90% of the time. I mean, there's days where you'll have something happen where you might have three for a short period of time, but we always backfill with overtime and do everything we can to get to that number of four. But sometimes in the winter when vacations are down and we don't have a lot of injuries or things like that, we run five. That's not our standard, but it does happen sometimes. But generally, like I said, well over 95% of the time we have four on an engine, four on a truck.
Okay. All right.
And then our TAC teams roll out with 8 to 10. Engine and ladder will go. Chief will go with them. And so that's what our staffing for our TACs are.
Okay. With this next question, before we talk about like other topics and you know, who you know and what you've been involved in, to get to that point, did you surround yourself or try to find firefighters you wanted to emulate?
Yeah, so I did, you know, and it's always, I was just kind of enamored and just really fascinated with the fire service in general. And one thing about, you know, Wayne Township back when it was, you know, back in the volunteer days, since it wasn't paid and they weren't, you know, paying everybody, they had the substantial amount of money. And they would really make any training opportunity. I mean, I went to a firehouse expo when it was in Baltimore, like way back in the like late 80s, early 90s as a 17, 18-year-old. FDIC was in Cincinnati for a while. We would go to that. They would bring outside instructors here. I actually got my opportunity to go to what they called at the time BERT school, Basic Extrication Rescue Technician, as a volunteer, which set me up when I became career to go to come onto the FEMA team. And I've made several responses there. So though, I guess the point of that was, and maybe we'll talk about this later as well, is organizations that are closed, you know, and they don't get a lot of outside view and they don't bring people in, and they don't let their people go out and see other things. That's a dying model, in my opinion. Like, you have to get out and with what we're doing, podcasts and things like that. I think that's helped the fire service a lot, you know, Facebook and Instagram. But still, you have to get out. You have to get out and put your hands on things, go to classes outside of your agency, bring people inside, even if they don't quite run your model, or maybe you disagree with their views on some of this stuff. You know, which as a country, that's uncomfortable for us right now. But I mean, it's just invaluable to be able to have them come in and send your people out to see how people do things and send them to outside classes so they can pick up. And, you know, anything I've done, we were looking early on to potentially get into the dive business here. When we were building, we decided not to for some other reasons, but you know, I went to dive school back then, so I've never been an active public safety diver, but I can tell you going to dive school was a changing experience for me in my career. And then going to the BERT school for the task force, which covers, it was a technician level, you know, I think it was 10 weeks back at the time, which is a lot of training. you know, on trench and confined space and ropes and all that stuff. Now we have, you know, at Wayne Township, we have a rope team and things, but we don't have trench. We don't have confined space. But you learn skills and philosophies and you work around other people and you're getting your hands on tools, you know, and you're doing things like that that just makes you a better firefighter. You know, so like I'm never going to be on a dive pack and, you know, jump in the water to make a rescue. But I can tell you what I learned in discipline, how to structure training, intense training. You know, we get into the smoke diver discussion later. Like that was all very changing for me, even as a firefighter, on air consumption, how to deal with stress and pay attention to detail, because there's really very few more detailed technical things that we do in the fire service than diving in black water. You know what I mean? By yourself, managing a ton of stress. So that was, you know, those skills, again, you know, we're not going to dive here at Wayne that I ever see. That 100% made me a more technical and better, more aggressive firefighter. So not allowing people to do things any other than what your day-to-day regimen is right. It's just a bad model for agencies. And a lot of people get into that and they use money as an excuse. I'll say it's an excuse because, hey, I'm a chief, right? I can sit here and say, well, we, you know, we can't afford that, but then we're affording other stuff, you know, that we want to afford. So I get that. And some of it, you know, firefighters, you know, maybe we do need to buy a new server that firefighters don't think is a good idea that we truly need. And yeah, we can't send somebody to, you know, whatever class, but we can also, most agencies, for the most part, you can fund what your priorities are. And unfortunately, a lot of administrations, their priorities aren't training.
In my opinion. And you've hit so many targets for sure. Yeah. But with what you just said, you know, I did a little research and talking through various people that I've been able to talk to, it's kind of astounding that with most fire departments, and I say most, I don't want to say all, maybe some, we can say some, the training budget is the least amount of money goes into the training budget. And that's kind of wild if you think about what we do.
It's terrible. You know, and there are things we have to do, but again, you know, our firefighters, in order to serve the community to their best ability, and if the community service to the community and taking care of them and meeting the needs of your community is not your firefighters' top priority, and they're not there for service, right? So that's domino one that's going to fall to create problems in your agency. And then if the firefighters or the majority of them are there for that, then they don't have a leadership team above them, starting with their company officers into their battalion chiefs and then into, you know, guys like me that are there to support that through, you know, I mean, we've got safety culture discussions and what's safe and what's not and how can we be safer, which is all valuable, but nothing we do is safe. When that bell rings and these guys go out and hit the street, it's unsafe. We can't be safe. We can be safer, right? We can put things in place to make them safer. We cannot blow red lights at 60, but it's still a dangerous thing from response until they get back in that firehouse. So yes, we manage as much of that, but you know, for these people to just say, well, they shouldn't do this, they shouldn't have went in, they shouldn't have did, you know, this or that or the other because it's unsafe. Well, it is our job to manage our people that are going into unsafe environments daily. Driving to an EMS run that most of us just kind of don't even think about, it's very unsafe, right? So that's the world we live in. So administrations, you just have to, nothing we do is safe. So how can we make it better? But if you don't train them and you don't, you know, teach them to work in stressful environments where they're trying to recognize things and be aware, and just, we keep people from falling into that complacency mode because we just do the same rudimentary things every day. How you accomplish those goals and make your firefighters and EMTs and medics and everybody else the best is through training. And it's got to be targeted, at times intense, focused training on what your people do, you know. And training divisions if that's not where they're at. And if your training is the least funded department in your organization, you're going to have a struggling, more unsafe organization, in my opinion.
No, that's very valuable. Very valuable. With us talking about training, let's just get right into it. Cause I actually like it. I mean, for me, I'm not a training officer, but if you want to call senior guy on my shift, you know, I do the crawl, walk, run. So like we'll do it. We'll do an evolution that I'm pretty sure mistakes will happen. We'll talk about correcting them. And then as they get better, I progress the steps of making the evolution harder. And you know what I mean? And like, I like doing that. So what's your take on the high intensity training?
Well, I mean, that's the way most firefighters learn. If you look at learning models, even adult learning, you know, for what we do, you know, a large part of our job is technical skill. I do think there's a loss. And even at our agency for a while, we got away from the classroom portions, which most people don't like. And again, what's your commitment to training? Well, we have public ed details and we have all this other training we have to do. And we have to do, you know, the testing, hose testings and ladder testing. And our folks are so busy doing all this other stuff, which all has value. Just like the training budget's the first one that gets, you know, dinged. It's then so our training time gets drawn back, right? And so that starts kind of hurting. So then we cut out the classroom part, right? So we don't have an hour and a half anymore. We got an hour or 45 minutes. So let's just get into the junkyard, put the tools in our hands and start cutting up cars. And show them, hey, this is where you put the wood block to crib the car, right? So we do that and we get our guys proficient at that. But then when they go to the run where they can't put the wood block there because there's a telephone pole or a semi parked on top of the car or that side of the car or truck's ripped away, then they don't know what to do because we didn't teach them the philosophy behind why you're putting the wood block there. We just said put the wood block there. So when there doesn't exist, they don't know what to do. So I like the crawl is there's got to be some background on even the Halligan bar, teach people how to force the door, wrap a frame, the communication process behind that. But if they don't know what the Halligan bar is and what the ads and the wedge and how it's designed for mechanical advantage, if they go to wrap the frame and it doesn't work, they don't know there's options with that tool, right? Because they're just so... I think no matter what it is, you have to have that initial foundation of knowledge that they get. And then you put them out and then you let them do the basics and build some repetition, right? And build up some muscle memory. And then you start kind of ramping it up and throwing problems of, hey, this doesn't work or this changed or things like that. And then, you know, and then you at some point on some levels on some of the training, we work in stressful environments. We do. We just do. Physically and mentally stressful. And if you don't train in those environments, you're not going to be ready for them when they come. And then you got to figure out how to respond when you could be in a very critical moment. So we can never recreate the fire ground, obviously 100% in training. But I think through the smoke diver programs we've worked in, the dive training I talked about, and I went to a couple like North Carolina has a breathing apparatus school I went to.
Oh, in Gaston County.
Gaston College. Yeah. So I went to that, you know, again, back in the day before I had no hair or white hair. but those kind of courses, they're around the country, you know, and they're sought out. And if you don't do that level of training, your folks aren't going to be ready. That doesn't mean you do it every shift. That doesn't mean you're just guys are exhausted at the end of every department training, you know, but you have to work that stuff in at some level to keep people proficient. Used to working in gear, used to being hot, used to having a fogged up mask, used to being pissed because, you know, whatever, you know, can't get the door forced or whatever. Like, they have to encounter that stuff. So those, their response to those things become more of a habit and normal, and they can kind of push through those without much thought. So if you do have a significant event or you're trying to create work through a real issue, like all that other stuff, again, we go back. I like that noise comment. You're not worried about that stuff because you're so used to not being able to see out of your mask. You can make it happen, you know, and figure it out. So I think and that training, there's not a big impact to your department budget on that. Like you can you can do some YouTube videos and do some quick Googles and go to like the Fire Department Training Network, which is here in Indiana, Jimmy McCormick's place. They push out a ton of good drills. You know, fire engineering, you can go there and get the drill of the day. Like, that doesn't cost money. That takes will, and that takes the heart to do it. And that
initiative. Yes, sir.
Exactly. So, yes, you know, budgets are a thing, and I'm not saying every department can just dump all their money into training. But if there are legitimate reasons that departments really can't afford some of that stuff, you can really train your people to be sharp, and it doesn't take anything but people wanting to do it.
You know, absolutely. So, absolutely.
You know, there's a lot we could just talk about just on that topic, you know.
With that being said, so you developed the Indiana Smoke Diver Program, but I'd imagine in order to do that, you had to go through a smoke diver program yourself.
Yes. Yeah. So the progression of that is, so to say, so I brought the me and about 15 other guys we'll talk about brought it to Indiana. We didn't develop anything here that was much different than the Georgia program. And then the Oklahoma program came a little bit after ours. So they kind of came out. We had some guys come here, some guys go to Georgia, and then they spun their program after ours. So so Georgia's like the mothership, you know, they're kind of like down there. They're the behemoth. And then we sent some guys down there. I was the first one to go to Georgia and was one of two of the first out-of-state candidates that graduated from the Georgia program. Before me and the guy that went with me, they didn't take out-of-state candidates. It was the Georgia Smoke Diver Program. And it was funded by the state of Georgia. Through the Georgia Public Safety Training Center in Forsyth, Georgia, and the Georgia Smoke Diver Association administered it, but it was largely they paid and funded the firefighters from Georgia to go at no cost back then. So to bring somebody from Indiana, obviously the state of Georgia didn't want to pay for me to go when the state of Georgia wasn't, you know. So so I was volunteering for, I guess, back then, the Fire Department Instructors Conference, obviously FDIC. And I was working in logistics there, and I was working with a guy named David Rhodes. And we kind of developed a relationship with there, and he was the logistics section chief, and I was kind of like the local guy. I was the Indianapolis Fire Department has a indie team that kind of does the local stuff for the conference, and then fire engineering brings in, you know, like their people, and then we kind of like marry up for the week and we run the show. So so David was that guy. So we got to know each other for a couple years and we worked together. And one year we were working together, he wore his Georgia Smoke Diver t-shirt, everything. And so I saw that and I was like, what is that all about? And he's like, oh, it's a class in Georgia. He's like, but you can't go. It's, you know, it's a Georgia thing and everything. So I was like, what do you mean I can't go? He's like, yeah, you know, and he explained what I just said. So I was like, okay. I was like, well, why can't I go? He's like, well, it's closed. You know, the state pays for them. I was like, well, what if I paid? He's like, yeah. He goes, man, there's really no way that you could pay. He goes, you just can't. So I was like, all right. So next year comes around. He wears a t-shirt again, you know. Couple other guys are wearing them around, you know, and I'm like, so tell me, like, what is this class? Like, what do you do in the class? And very much downplayed it. He's like, well, we just like searching, and it's writ stuff. And I did a lot of teaching back in that time of, search and writ. And, you know, I was in a lot of the hot classes at FDIC before I became part of the group that, you know, help that. So I'd been through all that stuff, and I competed in the police and fire games early in those years. So I was in pretty decent shape, and he was like, oh yeah, you'd love it. You know, he's like, you're in pretty good shape, and it's nothing you don't do now. It's, you know, the Denver drill and all this stuff. And he goes, yeah, but you just can't get in there. And I said, well, I mean, I believe it's a free country. I was like, I don't understand this camp thing. I was like, what if I just show up, you know? And what if I'm an extra guy? And he's like, man, you know, the the training, you know, I just don't know, might get us in trouble and all this stuff. So anyway, that was kind of where we left it this year. But then it was kind of like, I'm going to that class. Like, I, you know, and I could tell, you know, he was like, yeah, we need to figure out how to grow this too and get outside people. And so then somewhere between, I don't know, those FDIC events year to year, he gave me a call and he's like, hey man, I think we got it figured out. If you can pay for it, we're going to have a couple out of state spots to see how this goes. So my partner came from Ohio. I didn't know him. The guy that I was supposed to go to class with, I was actually training here once we got going, probably a month before we went, he hit his leg with a chainsaw and he was cutting a tree. And so he was injured. He couldn't go. So I drive down there by myself. I was really excited about it and really had no idea. I mean, I worked out, but I worked out every day. I would work out in gear like way before it was popular. You know, I see all this stuff now where it's kind of like the norm. I'm like, man, that was not the norm back then, but for many reasons I won't bore you with, but we used to work out in gear like even back then. So I was like, yeah, this is going to be fun. And I just didn't know about the daily runs. I didn't know about the morning PT. I'm not a military guy. I was never in, you know, I was in athletics in middle school, but I didn't grow. So I was too little I played basketball and wrestled. And once I hit high school, you know, I was kind of in a larger city high school and had 4,000 people in it. So, you know, I was little and skinny, so I'm not, you know, I'm kind of out of the athletics game. So I never really, really did that much. So when I got there, I mean, I'd never in the military. I'd never done arm circles. I'd never done burpees, stuff like that. And now we're doing it in gear and they're barking at you. And I'm like, man, that'd have been nice to know, you know, like my buddy, he sure didn't hook it up and tell me any of this, you know, like I'm figuring it out. And it was probably the toughest thing I've ever done, you know, up until that point, physically and mentally, just talking through what a struggle that was and not expecting it, you know. And fortunately was successful and passed the program. And just what it personally did for me was, you know, just being, because I'd never been to that level of pushing myself like a lot of athletes do. I'd never done a lot of that stuff. And when I kind of referred to that dive school earlier, that was probably the first class that was physically intense. Like we would run, the guy that taught the class at the time was like a plank holding member of the Navy SEALs. He was like a frog man in Vietnam. And then when they started the SEAL teams, he was that guy. So, I mean, he was just a hell of a guy, but you know, we would PT. I mean, we would run before some days before especially if it was pool diving, we'd do some pretty good PT before we got in that pool. You know, now when it was, you know, black open water, like we didn't do it obviously on those days, but I mean, the stress level was there and I had never experienced that in any fire service class. And it was stressful, you know, I mean, he made it stressful. And the way they, like you talked about the crawl, walk, run, that was very much the model. It was very much, I mean, you would go from diving in great conditions to duct tape mask and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I started kind of making that correlation between what training in the fire service could be like if we followed that dive model of starting easy, ramping it up, you know, starting in a swimming pool with a mask with basically no problems. You got multiple instructors around you. It's very safe, you know, to the point of we're diving at 50 feet in black water with no communications, you know. And so I was like, man, there's got to be, this is the best training to that point I had had. So I was like, if you could bring that into the fire service, into the firefighting side of it, like you got something there. So then, you know, probably 3-4 years later, I'm going through Georgia. And when I get out and I start reflecting back on that program, I was like, this is it. Like they're already doing it down here and they've been doing it for a long time. So that's where I really got that bug. And I kind of married those two experiences together. And then I hopped into, like I said, the North Carolina Breathing Apparatus School. Totally different than Smoke Diver, but absolute phenomenal RIT program, intense training, scenarios, realistic, like off the chart, just awesome. A lot of work, you know, I mean, you're exhausted at the end of the day. They didn't do the PT and some of the other stuff, but just I'm like, man, here's some more, you know, it's not the smoke diver model, but hard work. Sometimes you don't accomplish it. Sometimes you fail. You don't get them out, but you know, there, and that's where training at some point is, get you to the point where you're not successful and you fail. Because as most people, or I'm sure, you know, it sounds like the training you've done, that's where we truly learn about ourselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's a workout or it's whatever, and you're trying to make your time hack on a run and you don't quite make it, a lot of self-reflection, right? If you go run a race or you do a Spartan race and you think you're there and you don't hit it, you know, if you go crush that goal, you're like, yeah, I'm awesome, man. I knew I had that. And then you start, you just kind of become that status quo, where if you miss a mark by a little bit, and most guys that are doing these things have some drive, have some pride, they want to do well and they want to excel. So when you miss that mark, there's self-reflection and you want to improve. So, you know, again, training should never be punishment, but there's times that it should be hard and people get curveballs to where they fail. So if they miss victims, if they can't get something forced, you know, if they're not as quick as they could be, if they have water supply or the line stretch to the third floor just is terrible, like, let's reflect and do it again, because we don't get a lot. I guess sometimes we get second chances on the fire ground, but there will be times that we don't.
Right.
And if you miss your mark on those critical runs the first time, you don't get to go back and get a second shot. So that's what we want to happen in training.
Okay. Were there, I'm sure there had to have been pushback from others when you wanted to bring the smoke diver program into Indiana.
So there was, and the thing about it here in Indiana was it was largely an unknown. So within Wayne Township, which is, even when I went initially from Wayne Township, I had to pay my own way. Now, when I got back, they reimbursed me, but they didn't know what it was. And, you know, they gave me time off and let me use my gear, and they were very supportive there. But it's just like I paid my own way to get down there, which was fine. Paid my hotel rooms. I did all that kind of stuff. Right now, we cover that in the program. So it was unknown here. So really, it was more like people didn't know what it was exactly. So there was a bit of that. Just by, you know, I guess Murphy's Law, or just a stroke of bad luck, the year we launched it here and we really started pushing signups, the Texas Smoke Diver Program had a significant injury and death in their program. So it's a different program, and it wasn't structured like Georgia or Indiana was, but it still had that name of Smoke Diver. So, you know, generally the headline would pop up, you know, so-and-so firefighters die in smoke diver training. And then they get an email from me saying, hey, we're starting Indiana Smoke Diver. Do you want to send your guys? Right. So That was the first, our first year was like, well, that timing was not, couldn't have been worse, you know, mm-hmm. basically. And then just overcoming that people didn't know what it was. And is it a state certification? No. What do you get for it? Nah. You know, I mean, you get to go and train. Okay. Is it a, you know, guys trying to convince their wife to leave for, you know, six days and then pay out of their pocket and then train like hell for 6 months, you know, which is the biggest component, which if we have time, we can talk about. But, you know, doing all that convincing to like not really get a state certification, not get a raise at work, it's not going to help you get promoted. And then on top of that, if you're coming from Ohio or Idaho or Washington, and you get to wear an Indiana Smoke Diver t-shirt around, people are like, dude, why are you going to Indy? Like, what's, you're not in Indiana, you know? Right. And then you got to convince the family, hey, I want to go be an Indiana Smoke Diver. Cool. You live in Washington State. Like, what are you doing?
Right.
So a lot of that, you know, overcoming that. So we had a, you know, probably took 12 to 15 people in a class. And maybe graduates, there were class, I think we had a 4 graduation. I definitely had some 5s and 6s our first couple years. And the class is a class. So other than that, we start 48. We have, our applications are open now. Last year, we had like 480 people apply. You got to whittle that down. So 1 out of 10 gets in. And then of that, 50%, 40% graduate.
Mm-hmm.
But whether you have those numbers, whether we had 15 starting or 48, the class is the same. We don't change it. The standards are the same. They have the same requirements. The drills have to be just as intense. The instructor to student ratio when we're in IDLH, you know, very intense zero visibility operations. We still have to have 3 instructors for every student. So like whether you got 20 instructors teaching it or now we have around 60, it's got to be the same. So those first few years were tough. We had a lot of instructors like, man, this thing's not growing. Like, I don't know if this is for us. I don't know if it's catching on. You know, Georgia's been around since the late 70s, early 80s. You know, maybe this just isn't for this state. So we had a lot of those discussions. But, you know, I always went back to I knew what it did for me personally. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of class, even if we had 5 graduates, I always send them an email that says, hey, you know, you're 2 or 3 weeks out, you know, great job. You know, hope you realize your accomplishment, but send us some feedback on like, what'd you take back? And what we started getting was very little about it made me a better firefighter or really not fire service related things. There was some, but mostly it was, I'm a new person. And this sounds, you know, some of this is like, it's not really uncomfortable. I'm happy. I love talking about it. But when people that have an experience or not, and I equate it to try to explain to your parents, girlfriend, wife, significant other, whoever, what it's like to go in that first fire where it's zero visibility and the heat's got you on the floor and you can't see where the fire's at, but you hear it. Like, try to describe that to somebody that's not been there. And it's very hard trying to describe to somebody that hasn't been through the smoke diver experience what it's like is almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
We can tell you it's hard. We can tell you it's, you know, there's going to be some pain involved, some muscle aches and cramps. You're going to be frustrated. It's hard training. But until you experience it, it's just really hard to do. So, but we would get these things back about, man, it really changed me as a person. And I mean, you know, I'd be happy to let you see some of like made me a better father and made me more committed. You know, I was very complacent in my daily life and my organization, but now I know I've got some resiliency to be able to stand up and to accomplish more than I ever thought I could. And that carried over way outside the fire service. So when you start getting that stuff, it's like, man, that's big stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, honestly, I got chills sitting here talking about it. And so I'm like, man, if you can affect one firefighter and they get that, and even if it makes them a better firefighter, that's a huge win. What if it makes you a better dad or husband or right. son or, you know, daughter or mom or whatever? And it's like, dude, that's big, you know, that's getting out there. So we really, you know, put our efforts into look, if we get one and one person gains that, it's worth all this work and all that stuff. So we stuck it out through those early years. And like I said, now we're, you know, I wish we could run 2 classes a year. We just can't because it just takes so much like Georgia does. They've got 1,000 smoke divers down there and we've got about 125. So, you know, it's just hard to do 2 classes a year, but when we get there, we will, because it's just been that important. And the instructors come back for free. You know, we don't pay them. I'm sure you've discussed that model. I know you've had other Georgia guys on here. So it's that commitment. It's that servant leadership. And honestly, it's that labor of love where the fire service is kind of missing that. You know, we've lost sight of that. I'm not getting paid to be here. I'm here to help the guy next to me. I'm here to be as good as I can. I want to work. I like working, you know, like I want to be in my gear sweating, you know, on that fire. Like I want to leave it all there, man. You know, that's just lost. And a lot of it, I think, is through the way we train, and our safety culture's crushed a lot of that. You know, to your point, the training budgets, and it seems like the thing that support our firefighters to make them better firefighters and better public service, the first things to go in our budgets. Our administrations lose sight of that stuff. And then it kind of leads us to, you know, some of the stuff of where we've gone. But I think with the last couple of years, we see a bit of a resurgence, a lot of stuff on social media about getting back to, you know, being aggressive firefighters, being trained, being proficient, taking pride in, not being a firefighter, being a good firefighter, you know, not wearing the costume, but like throwing my gear on and being able to go like do whatever I'm called to do and do it as good as I can. Like that's what we're missing now out of the fire service and programs like this, not just smoke divers. I work with a lot of guys here that have never been through the smoke diver program. Some of them don't like it. Some of it do. Some of them would excel at it. It was just never their thing. And I would take them on any fire that I've ever went to. So it's not just about being that, you know, it's mm-hmm. not about being a smoke diver. There's just tens of thousands of firefighters out there that would meet that standard if they wanted to, or they even knew about it. But they have that mindset of, you know, hard work, being ethical, you know, going to serve the public, being sharp, like staying sharp, fighting complacency, fighting all that crap that just wears us out, and being those guys and girls. And that's where it's at, whether you go through Smoke Diver or North Carolina School or some other smoke diver program, or you just train hard in your gear in your garage at home. You know, I mean, that's what we're looking for. It's a characteristic of people. You know, when we get them in smoke diver, we're looking for characteristics. We're not looking for them like a smoke diver per se, or the biggest, strongest, toughest athlete.
Right.
We're looking for people that want to get better, that push through adversity, that can manage themselves and have some emotional intelligence, and that have a drive that they know, hey, if I get to this fire and it's the most difficult fire I've ever been to, I'm leaving it all there. You know, somebody's trapped. If somebody needs something, like I'm pushing through whatever I need to push through to get that job done for those citizens. You don't have to be a smoke diver to have that. Like I said, you'd be training in your garage and you've got that. That's what it is. So that's what we got to continue to cultivate, develop, and get that message out for our firefighters that, you know, we can't continue to drift where we've drifted through some of these initiatives that have hurt us.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the thing too, you know, I have interviewed several smoke divers, whether it's Georgia, Florida, whatever the case may be. And you know, that at least the humble ones will tell you, like, if you're not a smoke diver, it doesn't mean you're a bad firefighter. You know,
absolutely.
Like, everybody has, I mean, there's a time commitment. If you have multiple kids, like the schedule just has to work.
Yeah. But
what I like is, you know, that's the message that they're spreading. Hey, you don't have to have this shirt, this hoodie on to let you know you're good. Like you can
1,000%.
You know what I mean? Like you can do your own things in this field to make you a better person.
Well, and you know, the thing about the class is when I teach the Sunday portion of the smoke diver program, you know, and everybody comes in nervous, you know, it's just one of those things, right? Like that's the whole point of the program, is you should come in nervous. But, you know, when I'm in there talking to them, it's like, there's no bear traps here. There's nothing in the search building that's going to chop off an arm if you go the wrong, you know, way. And we haven't invented anything here. You know, like who's done searches and advanced hose lines and fought fire? Everybody's hands go up. Who's done subfloor rescue, the Nance drill? Who's done Denver drills? Who's done window bailouts? Who's done RIP drills? Who's done air consumption drills? I mean, 99% of the people raise their hands to all of those things. It's like, so you already know what to do in this program. Now we're going to wear you out and we're going to throw you some curveballs and we're going to teach you ways to do that stuff. Not the way, not our way. We're going to teach you ways to do it. And our instructors are going to kind of teach our program. But if you want to marry it with what you do, if we put you into a RIT drill and we show you how to lift people with tools and webbing and how to do drags and carries and convert stuff to harnesses and everything. But, you know, you're a big dude and you can basically pick somebody up, throw them over your shoulder and get them out. That's what we want you to do. The goal here is accomplish the mission as safely as possible. And again, as we already talked, it's not safe anyway, so you got to do your best, right? But accomplish the mission. If we teach you to use a piece of webbing and you don't do it in your drill, but you get it accomplished and you meet the goals, nobody's screaming at you saying, go get your webbing, you're doing it again. Like, it's like, take your experience and what you've honed. Here's our advice on some things. If you want to try those, good. But here's the drill, right? go over there with your partner or partners, take 5 minutes to get your game plan together, and then your showtime. And if you go knock it out, nice work. We're moving on to the next thing. So it's very much not our way or our program. It's a way.
Mm-hmm.
And then we let the students, you know, manage their own drills and kind of make critical decisions. And if it doesn't go well, they come out, we talk about it, they get to do it again, you know, for the most part. And that's where the learning comes in. You know, that's where the failure and then become successful. And if you do that, you'll do that probably more in this class than you will any other class. But if you continue to make those personal decisions to reevaluate, it's frustrating, your body's tired, you're hurting, but you know what? We got to go in there and get that guy out. So let's see what we got. And when you do that over and over and over, it changes literally the wiring in your brain to know that, hey, I can do this. You know, I am capable of, I didn't think I could get to the fifth floor, much less do a Denver drill, much less bring a firefighter down the stairs and get him out. I didn't think I could get my gear on because I was so tired. But you complete that task and you're like, damn, I just thought there was no way I could do that. And that's the value, you know. You don't have to go to Smoke Diver to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, my point with that whole little soapbox I got on was all those drills people do in their organizations, pick one, you know, add a little bit of stress to it and maybe run a mile or something before you do it. And then just try it out and see what you do. You're not going to be able to do it for 6 consecutive days, 12 hours a day. But if agencies did something like that,
right.
If they just said, you got to wear your gear, you got to be on air, and we're going to climb to the top of the tower and back down, and then we're going to do the stretch. Think of what that would do for the fire service. We're not talking about Smoke Diver and running, you know, miles a day. We're talking about walk up and down a tower, get winded, get your mask fogged up, now go stretch that line. Man, the face of the fire service would change in a year,
absolutely,
you know, if we just did that. So,
yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yeah. With that being said, you've been a part of, unfortunately, you've been a part of line of duty deaths, which occur in our field. And
yes,
they're all learning experiences that you can learn from things. Hopefully, you take away mistakes and you don't recreate those mistakes.
Yeah.
And I know you said you wanted to hit on that.
Yeah. So just a couple of things there. So I referenced that dive class that I went to, the public safety diver program. One of my friends that was in there, who was probably one of the strongest physical people that I had ever seen. He drowned on our last evolution there. Just, you know, terribly tragic. And, so that was a death that occurred in training, which was obviously impactful to me. And as I, you know, said before, it's very stressful training and, you know, and all these kinds of things. But he was a great firefighter. He was on a very busy company. I mean, ran ultra marathons all over the country. I mean, he was a beast, man. And he was so strong. But, you know, had some issues and, unfortunately, you know, there was a fatality in that class. So that was very impactful to me. You know, I'll never forget once we were done and, you know, we had to be interviewed by the police came in and I mean, it's a, you know, crime scene, not mm-hmm. anybody did anything nefarious, but, you know, just in the investigation and things like that. So we had to stay there the rest of the day and get interviewed and everything. So I picked all my gear up and I put it in the back of my truck and we're leaving. And as I'm pulling out of the parking lot, you know, his car's sitting there and I'll never forget that. Kind of tough to talk about, but I looked at that car and I'm like, man, there's nobody there to take that car home.
Right.
And I know he's married, you know, and I'm like, this is real, you know, mm-hmm. like you hear, it's easy to read, you know, see the patch with the black stripe and, you know, man, sorry, brother, we got it from here. And I'm not diminishing or making light of any of that stuff. But like, man, when it affects these agencies, I mean, that's like somebody's buddy, somebody's dad, somebody's daughter don't have a soccer coach, you know, no fun. Like, I mean, when you go there, it's like, dude, this is, you know, there are times when firefighters perish on the fire ground that we got to do everything we can. And I'm not saying, you know, that he did anything wrong. Please don't take that out of it. But you know, now that I'm in the administration, right, it's like we got to do everything we can to make sure our people are as prepared for these moments as possible. So you don't see the car sitting there, you know, at the end of shift when everybody's going home to their families and there's a truck sitting in the parking lot like, you know, so-and-so. I mean, somebody's going to have to come and get that truck, take it home because they're not there. Like, that was very impactful for me to just sit there and stare at that car for a few minutes. Prior to that, here at Wayne Township, we had a fire truck that rolled over. Two firefighters were ejected. One firefighter, and this was back in mid-90s, you know, for the seatbelt pushes and all, we just didn't wear them. So one guy was killed, struck his head on the pavement, and it was killed. He was transported, but he died that day. And then another guy named Rod Lambert, who was actually getting hired on a career fire department, he was ejected and he was paralyzed. So he lived in a wheelchair. We actually had his funeral a couple weeks ago. He passed away from complications due to that accident 30 years later. So it was a line of duty death, even though, you know, it happened 30 years ago. And so I responded to that run. And, you know, I remember, and Rod was a stud, man. He was a, you know, just a lean athletic. Like I said, he was getting on a career fire department. This freaking great guy. And he was laying on the ground and he was struggling. And so, you know, there was some people working with him, walked over there and he's like, I can't get up, you know, and it didn't register with me. And, you know, just being like, what do you mean, you know, you can't get up. And so then when they got him up and then we, you know, we hear, hey, he's paralyzed. And, you know, and that's a pretty tough scene to take in, you know, and then you think about it and then you think about it later where, again, you know, there definitely could have been some things done better to prevent that. And that's what we don't want for our people. So, you know, being involved in kind of those instances were definitely changing. And then we've had some pretty good injuries and things. So, you know, as an administrator, as an operations guy, you know, when I was a battalion chief, I always default to training, you know, to try to mitigate those things. Now, there's other things we have to do as well. But, you know, training people on those instances and making sure they're so good at their job technically that it reduces those accidents from happening. That's the most important thing we can do. And again, it doesn't take a lot of money to do that for agencies that do financially struggle. It just takes a recognition of people in charge and it takes the will to do it. So yeah, those were pretty big events for me that again, as we progress into the smoke diver training and through the dive school and all that stuff, it's just kind of wove itself together into the, you know, into kind of some of these philosophies and why I've done some of the things I've done.
No. I mean, it makes sense. And it's, I don't know if you want to call it like complacency, but there was a point in my career where you get complacent. You hit like the 5-year mark or the 7-year mark where you're like, okay, I think I've got this down. You know, we it's the same mundane movements, rotations. Absolutely. And so, you know, you get that complacency. But as I've gotten older, and the first thing to me that grew me was going to outside training because, you know, it got to a point where, you know, I thought about leaving the fire service altogether because I was just, I'm sitting there watching individuals and I'm like, we can't just like be okay with how, We're not rushing to the truck where we're walking or we're getting up and we're having to go pee first before we go out the door. And it's like, this isn't like right per se. Yeah. Yeah. And then you go to these outside trainings and you listen to these chief officers, these captains, these firefighters talk about things that you see in your own organization and it just clicks.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is the right way we need to do things. And then when you go, like for me, I went back and I just started studying the room or studying when we're at training and you just see the complacency everywhere, you know? And then when you speak on it or you start changing it for yourself and hopefully bringing other people on, that's where the judgment comes. Well, you think you're better than me or this, that, and the other. Yeah. So unfortunately, in my opinion, I hate that it usually takes a line of duty for that to click with people or something almost bad happening.
Well, and you know, and the thing is, I mean, that's so, you know, even when I was the battalion chief, I would check my pack every day. I would turn it on. I would breathe the mask. Very rarely did I put that on. I mean, maybe a less than, you know, count it on one hand. But it was still for me, you know, I just want to be example to my guys where they heard that pack on the other side of the bay chirp and, you know, whatever. And then two, that it's like, you know, I may not be in this spot forever. You know, or I may go to a fire today where I'm the second or third chief and I got to put it on, and I'm not going to let myself be complacent because I'm a chief and I know I'm probably not wearing this thing. So, you know, it doesn't, the guys that you're talking about and the girls we're talking about that get, I mean, I've been complacent, you know, won't speak for you, but you've probably been complacent. You know, we get tired. You know, you said you had a busy night last night. So if you're working overtime today, you're still tired. I'm like, man, I was here yesterday. I checked my pack. I'm good. You know, I'd get on the battalion buggy. It's like, you know, I know they didn't use it the last couple of days. I checked that it's good. You know, things like that. But so it's not that you're a bad person. You know, somebody gets a little out of shape. Somebody gets very complacent. I'm sure you or maybe have heard the normalization of deviance discussion about getting used to, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, that's normal human behavior. We do that every day in driving, not just a fire. Like, when I'm driving, if we're out for a walk, if we're doing things around our house, cut corners, do, you know, I mean, it's just normal human behavior. So if you're not in tune to that and you're not aware of it, it just kind of happens, you know, and that's where, like you say, it takes a significant event to kind of snap people out of that, which is true. But it's just because as we, you know, get more comfortable in our environment, that's just the norm for us. That's what, right. That's kind of how our body does. And that's how our brain works. So through training, back to that theme, you know, if we're working on people in training and we're doing things like that to try to keep them sharper, hopefully that helps some of that, you know, that helps push that off. And again, it's not, we got bad people and things like that. It's like, they're just doing what humans do. And it's our responsibility to make sure we're staying sharp and we don't get into those trends and those norms of that. So I totally agree with you. And it's hard, you know, because that's how we do. Like I said, even if we're not in the fire service, if you go to a fast food restaurant or you go to a manufacturing facility, there's complacent people there. You know, absolutely. It's just the way it happens. So it's not a jam to anybody or a slam to our firefighters or in the fire service. It's just, that's how we do if we're not on guard against it.
Definitely. Sneaks up on you. No, 100%, 100%. You know, this interview right now is being recorded on September 9th. And, you know, we're 2 days away from, you know, September 11th. If you're in the emergency services field, this is a special day for all of us and as well as civilians, but more so for us. And you've had your own 9/11 journey that I'd love for you to talk about.
Okay. Well, as I said earlier, we, you know, back when I went to that basic extrication rescue technician school, BERT school back then, qualified me to be on the one of the FEMA teams. There's 26 teams in the country, and Indiana has one of them. And back then it was Marion, it was kind of the Marion County Rescue Task Force. Now it's basically the state of Indiana firefighters and civilians from all over the state. But back then it was mainly just Marion County, almost exclusively. So that qualified me to be on that team. So when I became career at Wayne Township, I joined the team and I kind of, you know, got into a rhythm of training and very advanced, you know, like building shoring. And I mean, just stuff that I would never have done, you know, here, just a lot of advanced, heavy training and incident management, incident command training, just a whole lot of, and seeing an organization that, you know, you're like, oh, it's a rescue team, but they also have dogs and medical and logistics and communications people and finance people. So that was really like, wow, this is a mad, you know, it takes a lot to get that guy going into that collapsed building or whatever to support. So there was another thing that, you know, kind of I picked up from that how what it takes to kind of do things like that. So I got on that team just right at the end of 1999. And then my first deployment with them was to Ground Zero as a result of the terrorist attacks there. So we actually left on 9/11. We got in, we had a caravan because air travel was shut down, if anybody remembers, or whatever, nobody was flying. So we got in buses, and we have a large cache of equipment we take. I probably should know how many trucks we take, but I don't. But I mean, it's, I'd say 15 or 20 easy, of semis, straight trucks, command vehicles, the large coach buses that has the team. We're around 90 people when we take a type one team out. So a lot of people, a lot to move. So when we left the Indianapolis International Airport, we had a state trooper escort, and they took us to the Ohio state line. And when we got to the Ohio state line, the Ohio state police picked us up and took us to Pennsylvania. And then the Pennsylvania police picked us up, took us. And then when we hit the New York, the New York state. So it was, you know, just experiencing that ride out there and hearing all the, you know, whatever, it was just like, man, you know. And I mean, the state cops would meet us at the state line. We would stop. They would get on our buses and like salute us and stuff. And it was just like, just what a moment that was, you know, being in the fire service and then being able to, you know, what we were hoping to respond and, you know, like help and, you know, save people and things like that. So we got out there on the 12th and we were out there, worked for 10 days. At ground zero, and then we returned back home after that. So probably do a podcast in itself just on that, but just a big deployment and a lot of just incredible contacts and experiences working with, you know, the New York fire guys and cops and firefighters from all over that came and were just there working, you know, and pretty incredible experience to have been a part of that.
No, I'm sure that was surreal. And like you, I think back to what we talked about earlier and I was like, oh, I had the same, I wasn't in the fire service then, but my neighbor worked, I think he worked in the South Tower. He worked for the Department of Taxation and Finance. And on the side, he drove a cab part-time for extra money. Yeah. They brought his cab home after a couple of days. It was covered in that white soot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sat in the driveway, and I just, like, when they brought it home, I just looked at it and realized that man's never coming home.
Yeah,
like that was the silhouette left.
Yeah,
and it carries me through to this day. And then, like, different life experiences, I think, hopefully help you grow and develop, because after that, a few years later down the line, my mom got cancer. She fought it. She fought like hell, but she unfortunately passed away. But I dealt with the ups and downs, the ebbs and flows of taking care of her, watching my dad trying to, he worked through it, provided us things. Like, I think all those little different things, and pretty much what I'm getting at is, anytime I start to feel like sorry for myself for whatever reason, I think back to, you know, my neighbor. His kids, his dad never came home. I lost my mom. But just because I lost my mom, it doesn't, to me, it should make you like a better person. I don't know if that makes sense.
Absolutely. But,
you know, adversity, realness of things that we see, like, this is life. And I say that to say, I know, like, from all the podcasts I've listened to and different people I've interviewed, you know, they say everybody has a different level of into the job. And I get it.
I get it.
When you come into work and your side hustle is more of a passion, or, hey, let's go pull lines. Well, I already know how to pull line. I've been on the department for almost 20 years. I don't need to go do it.
Yeah.
That's where I'm like, I have a problem with that.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. And, you know, and like I've said, yes, not everybody's going to be 24/7, 365 listening to podcasts, training in your gear, reading every fire engineering article, you know, and paying to go to training. Cause, you know, you do, I mean, I, you know, hey, I got four kids and, you know, I did a lot of that stuff when I was young, but I also, you know, tried to do as much as I could, whether it's going to the fire academy and doing that type of training, or again, going to Smoke Diver, the North Carolina Breathing School, or going to Pensacola to go to the, you know, the fire training that, you know, that they have down there. Like, things like that, like, still try to make it a priority, at least to do it every, you know, couple years, or just, you know, just to try to do something. But, you know, I'm a, like, and I get not everybody's into it at that level, but you have to be into it the level that when you come into work and you hang your gear on that truck, that's your deal for your 14, 12 hour, 24 hour, 48 hour, like whatever shift you work, like you got to be all in on that day, right? When you leave, if you don't think about it, you know, but when you're there and you're going to training, 110%, you know, read something, listen to, you know, like take the time that you're there to focus on that. When you go and you got 4, 6, 7 kids, sick wives, family, life is in your face. Yes, I, you know, but at least when you're there, be present, you know, and be focused on that. And, you know, one nice thing about our job is if you do that, yeah, you know, our guys that got lawn businesses can pull their mowers in and power wash the decks and sharpen the mower blades, or, you know, they can do those kind of things because that's what's awesome about this job. But it can't replace what your focus is that day your gear's hanging on that truck, because it leads to all the other stuff that we've talked about as well. So definitely. I can totally agree with you on that.
And you know, one thing with LODVs that I try to read, it seems like there was always a mistake that led to a bigger mistake that led to a bigger mistake. It's just like a domino effect of this is where it started to go downhill.
99.9% of the time. You know, I can't remember the year, and I used to know more about this, but my memory is getting worse as I continue to get older. But there were some Buffalo firefighters killed years ago. I believe it was in the 80s. They basically, I think they pulled up to a gas leak. They stepped off the rig and literally this thing exploded. And I think it took out the whole company, something like that. Very sketchy details, so don't quote me on it. But literally one of those events to where they pulled up, stepped off the rigs, really didn't have time to do much, and it happened. Those instances are very rare for us. Usually it's, you know, when you read the NIOSH reports, like there's a lot of value to those NIOSH reports, but I'm not a super big fan of them all the way around. But it is largely a domino effect. Water supply, you know, I mean, I'll listen to our fires, or I'll go to one of our fires and it's like, hey, we first engine didn't get a plug. The map was wrong. I thought there was a plug there. Second engine get a plug. Which I'm fine with that. I get it. You know, like we want our engine companies bringing water, but there's also times that they, you know, like, you know, stuff happens, right? So they hit in, hey, we missed a plug, second engine, get the second plug or get the plug. Cool. Which means now the third engine, which is generally our RIT engine, because we always get two plugs. So now our RIT engine's laying a line. So they're delayed, right? So then I'll hear, hey, the hydrants froze on this one. So now I'm starting to think, okay, you know, things are starting to stack up, right? And then somebody's command's hit for control, or control's hit for command, or somebody's not answering their radio because now they're working a little bit out of position and they're focused and they're busy, right? So I start thinking, all right, we're domino, you know, we're things are starting to stack up here, and our people are like, I mean, they're very good about audibles and, hey, we got to do this. I mean, they're very good about it, but it's just when things like that happen, it starts, you know, just kind of stacking that deck against you. And if you're aware of it, you know that. If you're not aware of that, it definitely, sometimes it just becomes, you know, where you can't overcome it when you get kind of past that critical point. So I know when I'm listening to the radio and I start hearing two or three things that are not going as we would like them to, through no fault of our people, but just Murphy's Law and things like that, I want to hear that incident commander start keying in on better communication, better assignments, maybe started more company, like, you know, things like that. Like, somebody better be paying attention here, because we're not getting the first and second line laid well, and the first truck's in there searching and we left space for the truck. And, you know, like, if that stuff's not going on, like, I want to start listening to the tone of our incident commanders and be like, if they're not recognizing what's going on, then, you know, we want that to happen. So, yeah, it's very seldom just a, you know, one event and, you know, it's catastrophe. So,
absolutely.
Definitely.
Before we part out, I always like to ask the guests, and I always mention this just because it's just the way the fire service is. I always like to ask the guests, where would you like to see yourself retire what rank, things of that nature. And I always say it's not like a bragging, but everybody
Yeah.
has aspirations. So
Yeah.
you're already the ops chief, but before you
Yeah.
hang it up and you're done, where would you like to see yourself?
Where I would like to see myself isn't really tied to rank.
Okay.
I'm not really a big rank person, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm a chief now, and I don't know, I guess retire as a chief. I'm set to retire in a little less than 2 years.
Oh, okay.
So July of 26, and I don't know if I stay a little longer than that, but we're moving. My wife, she just got her PhD. She's in counselor education, and she's been working in the field of firefighter mental health and training, and so she's kind of working in that. So we've toyed a little bit and done some teaching and presentations surrounding that. So I don't know. I guess just be impactful in the fire service. Help as many people, as you can, and I guess be an example. I don't, again, that's not tied to a rank for me. It's kind of tied to relationships you have with people, and whether it's helping facilitate on a very small level. My part in FDIC is very small, but working in that and help and be a part of something that brings 30,000 firefighters here to the city of Indianapolis, and maybe they gain something from that. Bringing the smoke diver program here and having 120 graduate, but having hundreds of others that have applied, have trained, maybe haven't made it. Hopefully that's made them better. Just being involved in some of the other things I'm involved in, I think that's where I would like to see myself. I don't even know if that's where I see myself. Just maybe the impact you have,
Right.
And then as I'm here, I mean, being in the administration is tough. I'm not definitely trying to, to elevate or, say, you know what I'm saying? Brush my chief's bugles off here and polish them up and, whatever. But I mean, there are sides to the administration that are tough, but, we have to realize that we're here to first also serve the public, even though I'm not hopping in the back step and going on every run. And then very close second to that is to serve our firefighters and EMTs and medics and make sure they have everything they need, training, equipment, support, mental health support, physical support, everything we can do to empower them within our power to support them to make sure they can serve that citizen. So I don't know where I want to see myself, but I definitely want to see myself as having that impact. And then when I retire, maybe there's a piece where, my wife and I are able to do some education on firefighter mental health or, things like that. I don't even know where this is, but a side note to that is a large part of our, I don't want to tie it, say our mental health crisis. I mean, I would say we're in a crisis, mental health wise, but administrations can do a lot to mitigate some of that through
Sir.
support. They can't fix it all. Not everything is their fault. But when, we already talked, this is not a safe job, for a chief to harp on people for not being safe and doing all those things. It's like, yeah, we can be safer and we need to be smart. And again, through training, I'll keep beating that drum. It's how we get better and safer. This is not a safe profession, So we have to support our people to make that happen. And that comes to the mental health side of putting people in conditions to where, their work conditions, and I'm not talking about how much we get paid and all that stuff. I'm talking about working conditions when they're going to runs that they're empowered and they're trained to be successful. And then when they see something that's hard or when they do something that doesn't work out exactly as they wanted it to work out, like we understand that, we're not coming down. Why'd you go in that window? I mean, we know what's going on in some of these places around the country where it's like, oh, well, they shouldn't have been there. They shouldn't have went there. Like, well, then why do you have them? Like our job is to just, to, I'm sorry to kind of get on this one real
Oh,
quick,
you're
but
good. Go.
we had a run I was involved in several years ago where we removed a couple kids and they ended up passing away, unfortunately. That was a pretty tough run for me. And then we got nominated for a lot of awards. It was a tough fire, and I mean, it was a tough fire. And you know, again, everything we do is dangerous, but this is probably more than most, you know, and all the fire conditions were terrible and doors were burned through and all that stuff. And fire was in the room where the kids were and, you know, all that stuff. So I really struggled with that. And then when you start getting like, oh, you're going to get this medal of this, or you got nominated for this in the city or the Red Cross. And I'm like, I'm not going to do that. You know, like nobody got saved. Kind of felt like I kind of screwed it up to some point. You know, I only saw one kid, kind of stumbled on the second one, which kind of threw me off my game. And then it kind of, and I'm like, man, I didn't feel like I did a great job there. Looking back, it would have made no difference. But, you know, in those days after, I'm like, I'm not going to get these awards. And so we had an operations chief here at the time. His name was Harry Tibbetts, and he had come from the city of Indianapolis. He was their ops chief for a long time. So he was kind of my boss. I was a captain, but I went in and I'm like, hey, I'm not, no disrespect, but I have no desire to go, you know, get this award from the Red Cross, or, you know, like, I don't feel like things worked out. You know, I don't think we get awards for kind of what I looked at, honestly, as a bit of failure and things like that. And he said, let me tell you this. He said, we don't determine the outcomes of what we do. He said, these awards are for people that put themselves in positions that nobody else can, to get those people that can't get themselves out and give them their best chance. He said, so we equip and train and give you guys all these radios and air packs, fire trucks, fire stations in every neighborhood. So when those moments come, you guys are there to give those people the best shot that they can get. You can't control the outcome. But our firefighters go into those spaces and do things nobody else can to give those people the best chance they can. And if that's what you did and the outcome that is out of your control is not what you were looking for, that's not why we're getting that. And it's not just me, you know, firefighters that get awards in general. He's like, that's not what it's about, because we can't control that. But we can control how we operate, and we can't control if we did what's expected of us. And he said, it's what we did. So, you know, bad outcome, not what we were looking for, but you got to focus on that and take pride in, we did the best we could. And he said, if that's where you're at, then the people that we serve, that's what they look for. That's what they expect. And so let them recognize that for the bigger fire service, you know. And I, man, that conversation was him with him. I was like, that's another career changer, you know, for me right there. I'm like, never thought about that. So, yeah, so that was a big one too. So, yeah, a lot to cover, I guess. But
no, it's another gem being dropped, yeah. You know, because I get it. Like, I'm with you when you were like, I don't want to go. I'd be the same way.
Yeah.
But then if you had that conversation and like, I listened to what you said and I'm like, he's right. Yes,
yeah.
That's not the outcome we wanted. And that's one thing I still learned to keep in the back of my mind. Control what you can control. As firemen,
yeah.
It's so easy for us to get wrapped up and
yeah.
ramped up on dumb stuff that we can't
yes.
control. And it's like, just chill out.
Yeah.
Worry about what you can do to make
yeah.
your station life
yeah.
better, whatever the case may be.
It's one of my biggest things, you know, the kind of smoke diver program in general, but it's like, you're your own best project. Like, if you're not getting paid what you think you should get paid, that's what you're getting paid, you know. And this is not a disrespectful thing, but it's like, if that's not working for you, work to go somewhere that pays you better, if that's what you need to do, right? Or accept where you're at and then focus on you, you know, get better. Like, that stuff's out of your control. That's, you know, politics in the fire service. Again, another podcast, right? But like, you're your own best project. You can't change people. The older we get, you know, you can't change people. We can't do those things, but we can change us. We can change how we respond to people. We can change how we train, our education level, which training and education, two totally different things. You know, if we want to go to college and do that, or if we want to go to EFO at the Fire Academy, or if we want to just become more technical firefighters and go to, you know, our local fire colleges or classes, FDIC, things like that. You know, those are things that we can control. And then if you have other things that are working against you, once you get good, right, don't throw stones in a glass house. Like, if you're working on you and you're trying to get better, then start branching out, trying to make an impact on other firefighters. But telling them how good you are is, I don't want to hear that from anybody. I tell you, smoke diver or not, like, Yeah, I got it, man. You went through the class. I went through the class. I went through the class almost, geez, almost 20 years ago now. That what are you doing since then? You know, what are you doing to either carry that mission to stay sharp? You know, like what are you still doing? Like, and that's what, as you said, focus on what you can do. Focus on yourself. Be an example. A quiet example is much better than a talker, a loud, watch me. I did this 10 years ago. Like, make people in, like, why is, like you said earlier, oh, you think you're better than me, all that. No, man, I'm not, hey, I'm not down on you. I didn't tell you to come do this. Like, I'm working on me. I'm not mad at you for you do you, man. I'm doing me. If you think I'm crazy for doing this deadlifts in my gear or running in my gear or, you know, whatever I'm doing, like, that's cool. But I got your back when you need it. I know you got mine, you know, and that's where we got to be. And so it's not about all that stuff. But and then it, I'm telling you, I've watched it happen. People start, that one person makes a change, right? I've had very unhealthy firefighters in my station. They're like, I ain't doing all that crazy stuff, flipping tires, wearing my, you know, face piece, breathing air. But I'll, when you're out, like I'll wear my shorts and t-shirt, like I'll walk up and down the stairs when you do stairs, or when you know, walk around the station, I'll walk with you, or I'll flip the cards for you on your decks of cards, you know. That's making a difference, man. You know, if that guy's doing nothing more but walking another mile a day or climbing stairs than he would have, that's progress. That's all we're looking for. And so, you know, it takes one person to stand up and make a change. And it's through example. It's not by being a loud, look at me barking type person. It's a, you know, you want people to kind of emulate and see value in what you're doing. And that's only done through your example. I might not like what he's doing, but if it goes down, I'm gonna quietly say, I hope he's on the back step with me. You know, they may
Right.
not say that out loud, but
Right.
yeah, that guy's a whatever, but if it goes down, yeah, I want him there. That's
Facts.
what you're looking for.
Facts. Facts, Chief.
Yeah.
Facts. With that being said, I kind of forgot to ask, engine or truck or rescue work for you?
So I've never worked on a rescue, like solely assigned to a rescue. So from the outside, I would say rescue. But definitely truck. I mean, I spent of my, you know, my time here, 15 plus years, like I said, on our busiest ladder company. And we did rescue, heavy extrication. We did some rope stuff. They weren't into water as heavy as they are now, but I just love the FEMA team, you know, back to that, all the heavy rescue, structural collapse, shoring, trench. I love any type of rescue stuff, just tools and, you know, just I kind of dig that stuff. But for in our world, we have engines and ladders. Ladder, I mean, you know, all day
All day
long.
long. Trucky for life. Awesome. Awesome. Man, I gotta give a shout out to Griffin. Griffin Spain Howard. He's the one that made this possible. I always like to give credit when it's due. He sent me a text and he was like, no, actually, he sent me an email. He's like, hey, I got a guy for you. I was like, all right, man, shoot. And I was like, here's my number. So whenever you're ready. And then he sends me this huge text and he's like, I got this guy. His
Oh,
name's
man.
Chief Stewart. Like, you need him on. I was like, done. So Griffin, thank you very much, sir, for making this possible. This has been a great conversation. Chief, I really appreciate you coming on here, spreading the good word, letting people know it's okay to love the job. It's okay to be invested.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. If you're going to be good at this job, you have to love it. You have to love the service aspect of it. I mean, you have to. You know, back to Dave Rhodes real quick, and I'm if we need to cut it, we can cut
No,
it.
we're
But
good.
yeah, but he, you know, I was really struggling with. I'm like, you know, this fire department, my fire department currently has been through some tough last few years. I mean, pretty tough. And you know, and but I'm like, you know, you got guys on one hand that are. They don't care what happens, man. They're here putting their gear on a rig, doing gear workouts, going out doing details, cleaning the rigs, checking the tools, like, you know, kind of not oblivious, but they're like, look, whatever's going on, whatever these crazy chiefs are doing, whatever the, you know, all this stuff, they're like, love to work here, best place I've ever worked, like, wouldn't want to do anything different. And then you got a guy across the bay or maybe at a different station, freaking hate this place. You know, we're not getting this, we're not getting that. Nope, you know, all the, you know, people don't know what they're doing, just miserable. And I'm like, you know, and I was just talking to, I'm like, man, how can you have the same circumstances? And I'm sure you have that in your fire department, where you have the people working for the same people experiencing the same things, and you got a group that's like getting after it, that's positive, that wants that bell to ring for that tough run so they can get out there and perform and do their job. And then you got the other people that are so frustrated and disgruntled. And that doesn't mean they're bad people. Don't get me wrong. They've just got into a position where you've got this group that's here and this group that's like, man, I don't even want to go out because I'm so irritated or frustrated with my chiefs or, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, how does that, those two things exist sometimes on the same rig, you know? And he was like, he said two things. He said, one, if you're not in this career, the fire service, to serve, he said, that's a problem, because if you're not here to serve, you're going to be miserable. And he said, two, if you care, it's harder, right? If you care about, if you're stressed out about what's going on, things like that, like it makes it harder, you know, and more frustrating and things like that. And it's not that, you know, the guys over here don't care, but it's like people that are really invested in this job and become frustrated in those instances because they care. You know, the people that don't care, like, you know, whatever, man, I'm getting paid next week, you know, all those kind of things. And you're looking at these other guys and you're like, why are they not stressed and worried about this and trying to get better at the job and, you know, things like that. And, you know, unfortunately, maybe some of them have come to the place where they, you know, don't care as much as they want did, or they're just kind of beat down over it. So, you know, caring makes you, it can put you into a bad place, but if you kind of go over that, you know, it makes you still want to get to that service aspect and, you know, provide that level of service. So, you know, that's ultimately, we can't lose sight of when those people call 911, we're all they got. And shame on us if we're not what they need when we get there. So I think I lost your audio.
We're good?
Yep, you're good.
All right. It kind of all goes back to, you know, the citizen doesn't call 911 and go, hey, like, I want the worst crew to my house for this right now. They expect every single crew that arrives, wherever you live, they're sending me the best.
Yeah. Well, it was like, you know, the Brunicini thing, the Phoenix chief, you know, it was out there for 30-ish years or whatever. He's like, when they call 911, you know, if their water heater's leaking, they want four plumbers to show up. If their, you know, mom's having a stroke, they want four neurologists showing up. If they're having a cardiac arrest, they want four cardiologists to show up. If their house is on fire, they want four, you know, fire science professionals to show up, or fire engineering technology. Like, that's what they're looking for. And we obviously can't be all of that stuff, but we can be good. And we know what we respond to for the most part. Mm-hmm. And if we come up on something that we don't know, or we've never responded to, we can at least recognize that we're still serving them and we're going to try to figure it out and be nice to them and do the best we can to help them. Because that's why they're calling us, and they don't have another option, and they don't get to pick, you know, the most fit, whatever crew. They get to call 911 and the dispatcher's like, hey, station X is coming. And hopefully you get the guys we talked about that are committed and care and, you know, that are working out and training, because if they do have those kids, again, another side stories we won't get into, but a couple guys over the last year have sent us just incredible stories of rescues they've made and fires. They've, like, third floor, just incredible things that you're like, man, it's and they get people out, and it's like, that's the one, you know. One of your questions real quick, it was like, you know, what does the term aggressive mean to you? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That was one of the questions. And it's like, you know, every fire is not the Super Bowl, you know, but we have to be aggressive and moving with a purpose on every single one. And we have to have benchmarks. And if it's food on the stove, we still walk through and search the house and clear it and check for extension. You know, if you're going over ladders to a third floor with black boiling smoke coming out into a third floor window, yeah, things are ramped up, right? But we should still be, our search priorities should be the same. you know, we got to pay more attention to what we're doing and know we're on more of a clock, but how we operate, our mindset, being comfortable, that's when that stuff becomes so much more important. But you got to have that skill down early. So, you know, being aggressive is, I think, being technically proficient and trained and skilled. So you can push in those times, but every fire doesn't require that push. And every fire is not like a search and destroy suicide mission, you know.
Right.
But some fires are, and that's when you got to have it together and you got to be ready to, you know, to go to work and push through, you know, high temps or zero visibility, or maybe pass some fire that you're like, you know, but I know I got a hose line coming, or I got my guys with the can coming and I'm going to give it a shot. Like, you know, that's on the edge right there. And it takes training and competence to ride that edge. And if you're not training and fit and competent and comfortable in those environments, you're not going to make that push. And sorry for whoever needed you.
Right, right. That's and the citizens usually suffer.
And that's not a place. I don't want that on me, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, it's 100%, you're 100% right. And then, you know, some will fall back and be like, well, they're already dead before we got there.
Yeah.
And it's like, we don't know that. It's like, yeah, that's their default to the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, nothing we could have done. Really? I mean, maybe, right?
Mm-hmm,
but,
mm-hmm.
You know, but if that's where you want to go, you know, that's on each person. But, like, I don't want that, you know,
right.
For me. Like, I don't want to be like, well, there's, you know, we could have never made that. But then you look at a fire, you know, down the road in another city, and you're like, dude, they made that one, you know. And so, and again, it's not being reckless and dangerous. It's not being, you know, just diving into a window on fire because you think, like, there's places that aren't tenable,
mm-hmm.
you know, absolutely. Very seldom is 100% of the structure not tenable. Very seldom. You know, you get fully involved and then you get, oh, well, is that window doesn't have anything coming out. That ain't fully involved. That's heavy involvement. You know, we got some fire extension, but you put a hose line in operation, that's going to check that really quickly. And then, but we could already be working from the, you know, this side that looks good. So, you know, there's a lot of that. And, you know, the nature of the fire service is, you know, we stand on the backs of giants in the past. And, you know, why do we get, you know, the accolades? And I mean, you know, probably something that a lot of people don't want to say, but we can go and really mess up a fire. And what do we get? The citizens? Oh, you guys are so brave, man. It's raining and you guys are out here and I appreciate what you did, you know. And we get that based on, you know, the history of the fire service and, you know, just the rescues and what people expect the firefighters and, you know, the thing they have of us and the perception of what they think we are and what they think we're going to do. And so we have a big pass. You know, we get a pass all the time, even if we don't do the best we could.
Right.
But we should never take advantage of that. You know, like we that should, you know, it's like, hey, no, we didn't do it as good. My guys didn't do as good here. I didn't personally do as good there as I could have done. And I, yes, they think we're great and so brave and, you know, that's good. But like, no, we didn't do as good there. So.
No, you're absolutely right. You're
yeah.
right. I mean, because with 2024, you know, the microscope is huge on the police department. And I think it's slowly trickling. It hasn't gotten to that point, but it can if we're not careful.
Well, it can. And, you know, there's places like there was an apparatus accident in Kansas City a few years ago now.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's an apparatus operator that's, I mean, he's serving time, right? And so ultimately, you know, we can live on that free pass until we can't. And it could be illegal. You know, it could be somebody's going to jail or somebody's getting sued, or it could just be like, look, man, I'm not living with that on my, you know, somebody that. You know, back to the one earlier talked about getting the award for the thing, like, you know, we couldn't control the outcome, but we got them out, got them to EMS. They did their best. Like, that's all we can do. You know, I'm not going to live with that. Well, it was pretty bad in there. And, you know, they probably were dead anyway, or like, we don't know that, you know? So if we can intervene, then let the medics or let them get to the hospital. They make that call. But, you know, our job is to get in there. Like I said, Chief Tibbetts has said, get into those places nobody can go and get them out. Then let, you know, kind of everything run its course from there. So I would never want that personally or to have those questions of myself. Obviously don't want to get, sued or go to jail, but for me, it's more of a personal thing of, I want to know I was as fit, I was prepared, I was as trained, and I did everything I could. And if they still, passed away, or God forbid, I've never had a, a firefighter be trapped or anything like that. But if they are, like, I got to know they drug me out. I was exhausted, and my crew, we were like, there was little, it was going to be us in there too. And then, but until you're at that point, we can throw all these, nothing we could do. It was fully involved. We're not allowed to do this. Our chief gets mad. If your chief gets mad and you got to go in a window and search for that 3-year-old, I'll let my chief get mad, but I got to know I went and did what I had to do, what I'm here for. Not because of my organization, but because of the fire service demands of me to provide that service to people that call the fire department. Yeah, I work for you. People work for me here. I work for people here. And yes, there was a big component of that, but it's like, a firefighter is expected by their community to be a firefighter and to come in and sometimes lay it all on the line for them.
100%.
That transcends being an employee, volunteer firefighter, same expectation. Like, it's not about your paycheck or that. It's like, you're a firefighter in your community. That's what they know of the fire service, and that's what they're looking for. So shame on us if we don't provide that for them.
100%, Chief. Best way to end this conversation.
Yep.
Man, thank you. I appreciate taking the time to come on and do this.
Yeah, I hope we didn't go too long.
Hey, even if we did, I think the listeners enjoyed it, because I sure as hell did. So thank you.
Well, I did too. I'm not a big, I don't get outside the, I've done a couple, we do an internal podcast here at Wayne, but I haven't done a lot. So yeah, this is a first for me too. So hope it goes well.
I think this might be, I think after this conversation, once this episode gets out, there'll probably be some more, anybody know this guy? Let's get in contact with him. So
yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see. But ultimately, like I said, people just when it comes down to it, know that you're a firefighter here to serve your community, paid, volunteer, whatever, on call. Know what your community expects of you, and don't squander that. Don't take advantage of it. Don't become complacent and, get to those places where you don't care about it. Like, they need us, man. They're millions of dollars. Our budget here at our fire department's 35-ish million, stuff like that. Our fire trucks are 1 and 2 million, like all that $6,000 worth of gear and fire gear and air packs, like all of that is to get us in that bedroom in the middle of the night when you can't see and you're not sure where the exit's at and it's uncomfortable. That's what all that's for, man. Dispatch centers, I go on all day long about it, but that's why that's there. There's fire stations in every neighborhood to make that cardiac arrest and save that life, or to get in that window or get up them stairs and give those folks every chance that we can give them. So that's where we got to end it, I guess. But yeah, man, that's the big thing.
Awesome, Chief. Well, like I said, I appreciate your time, sir.
Yeah, I appreciate the call.
Awesome.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.